conference. I should say when the conference was first announced, the subject was motives and algebraic cycles in honor of Spencer Block. I really didn't think I'd have much to contribute because I really don't know very much at all about cycles, except maybe these days bicycles. Although I admire the work of motives, people have done the motives a lot. I've really, again, contributed almost nothing to that field. People have mentioned the work that I did many years ago with Spencer, the paper called the Block-Ogres paper, in which we proved Gerson's conjecture. Again, the idea of using cycles and so it's completely Spencer's. I didn't have much of a deep understanding of the ideas behind that paper, but I got interested in it because of its application to Durham cohomology, and I was a student of Robin, and I thought I should be able to answer any question about Durham cohomology that people asked, and when the problem was phrased that way, I thought I should be able to contribute to it. Nevertheless, I was really importuned to come, and I thought, since I owe so much work to so much to Spencer for many other reasons, he's been a really important influence on me, not just because of that thing in 1974, but for other reasons as well, I really thought I should take the opportunity to come and try to pay tribute to his work. So I had intended to talk on a small thing that I did with Ellen Aynel. By the way, another thing that I learned from Spencer is how useful it is to try to work with Ellen Aynel. And so we did this thing over the summer, which was sort of related to motives. But at the last minute, I decided not to talk about that because about 2 weeks ago, we got back a referee report on a big paper that I did with Vadim Vologodsky in 2005. That paper, by the way, also was an outgrowth of some ideas that I got from Spencer maybe in the year 2000. And the referee pointed out a sort of mistake in the paper, but also pointed out that, you know, well, we didn't really use that part of the mistake, which was in some sense a remnant of an abandoned idea for a proof which we had changed, and said that the simplest possible case would be enough. And we realized that if we use that simplest possible case, we could in fact eliminate the unpleasant hypothesis that one of the main theorems required and prove a lot more. And so I'm just too excited to talk about anything else. So that's what I'm going to talk about. So the title of the talk is actually Functoriality of the Cartier Transform. I'm sorry? I should thank the referee, yes. So I don't know who the referee, well, I don't really know who the referee is, but certainly it's thanks to the referee that this talk is taking place. I don't think it's Spencer. And this is a joint work, and it's still sort of in progress in some sense with Vadim Vologodsky, as was the original paper. I should also say that I think I'm perhaps second in the room as to who has known Spencer the longest. I believe we met in 1970, maybe 1969. I was a graduate student then and had just taken algebraic geometry, and he came to a seminar that I was giving just to try to learn some stuff from Serre and from, I don't know if he came to the seminar on curves on an algebraic surface or not, but he was one of the most critical members of the audience. I remember that when I was trying to speak. I also should mention that at that time, I believe his thesis advisor was Steve Kleiman, and Spencer constantly complained about the fact that Kleiman kept insisting that he work on algebraic cycles. So, so anyway, it turned out well. Okay, so I'm going to review, first of all, the background to this theory of the Cartier transform in the complex analytic case, partly because I like to put things in context, and partly because there are things there that I don't understand, and maybe people from the audience can help me out. It's embarrassing how little I understand about these basics. Uh-oh. Can I erase this somehow? Okay. So the theory of the Cartier transform is supposed to be a mod P analog of non-Abelian Hodge theory. So let me review what I mean. What non-Abelian Hodge theory is supposed to be in characteristic zero over the complex number. So suppose X over C is a smooth projective variety. Um, then one has the Durham complex of X over C. And one also has the Hodge complex, which I guess is just the sum of the omega q's as a complex with zeros as maps. And Hodge theory gives you an isomorphism like this between the hypercohomology of this, well, I should maybe put in here topological application. This calculates, because of the holomorphic Poincaré lemma and Gaga, the cohomology of the analytic space with coefficients of the constant sheaf, and then using Hodge theory, that's isomorphic to the cohomology, hypercohomology of this Hodge complex, which is, of course, nothing other than the direct sum of those cohomology groups. So this is not really an algebraic statement, because here we have a direct sum, and here we have the cohomology groups, and I guess the algebraic statement is that the Hodge spectral sequence degenerates at E1, but I don't think the actual decomposition is really algebraic. And in particular, if you're working over a family instead, I don't think this is really right. So, I mean, there's a theory of variation of Hodge structure which doesn't involve an actual splitting of the Hodge groups in a family. So, I'll try to make that difficulty a little bit more important in the next part of the review. In the non-abelian case, this is work of Simpson, Corlett, and other people. I really don't understand this very well at all. So here, the idea is to try to understand not just the cohomology of X and with coefficients in the complex numbers, but the cohomology of Xn with coefficients in some representation of pi 1. In other words, some locally constant sheaf of C vector spaces. And I think it's especially important to understand, well, the theory is especially mysterious, perhaps, when that representation of the fundamental group does not come from a motive, but it's just some abstract representation. It doesn't underlie a variation of Hodge structure. So it's a non-motivic. So such a representation of the fundamental group can be expressed algebraically as a module with interval connection. So let's start there. We have E nabla, a module with interval connection on the algebraic space. So the connection is simply a map from E into E tensor omega 1, satisfying the Leibniz rule, so it's not linear, and it's integrable. I won't write down that for me. Yeah, all connections are probably going to be integrable. And this is supposed to satisfy some sort of stability condition. For example, if it's irreducible, that's okay. I don't want to make that explicit. Anyway, so what Simpson does is he associates to this guy, in some rather mysterious, at least to me, way, another object called a Higgs bundle. Or so E prime is going to be, this is an object in Higgs. Again, satisfying some stability condition, which I'm not going to try to make explicit. And so theta is now a linear map satisfying, again, an integrability condition. Here, delta squared is 0 in an obvious sense, and here, theta squared is 0 in an obvious sense also. Another way to say that is, for each derivation or for each tangent vector field, one gets a linear endomorphism of E prime, and those are all supposed to commute with each other. So you get an action, and it's really useful to think about it that way. This is an action of the symmetric algebra of T of X on E prime. So E prime actually becomes a sheaf, coherent sheaf, not any more locally free, on the cotangent bundle of X. And that's another useful way to think about it. Okay, so he associates an E prime like this, and the analog of that statement up there, for some reason they call it formality, and what it says is something like this. So there's supposed to be some sort of isomorphism in some sort of derived category, and I'm not exactly sure what it is, between the Durham complex here And the complex that you get by iterating this guy, this is the so-called Higgs complex, the Rom complex and Higgs complex. Now, the thing is, this is, first of all, it has to be global. This is not a localizable statement. The construction of E prime depends on X being compact and choose of some harmonic metric. And here, too, I don't think this is some isomorphism in some category of sheaves. It's something else. I'm not sure exactly what goes on. And we try to restrict to open subsets here. But anyway, one does get an isomorphism between the cohomologies. So the cohomology of E, hypercohomology of this complex, which again, by holomorphic Poincaré and Gaga, calculates the cohomology of Xn with coefficients of the corresponding locally constant sheaf, which is just a set of solutions, local solutions, of the differential equation corresponding to Nabla. And that's then isomorphic because of this guy to the cohomology of this Higgs guy. Now, this guy is linear, and this guy is not. So you might think that means this one is easier to compute than this one. And often that's not the case. I often use this one to understand this one because this is more rigid somehow because of the connection. So for example, well, all right, that's all I'll say. In the paper with Helen, that sort of emerges. This is the harder one to calculate sometimes. Anyway, so the other thing I want to remark is the correspondence between E and E prime is, again, not holomorphic. If you move E around in a family and E prime moves around in a family, the correspondence, even though these are both in moduli spaces that are complex analytic varieties, the correspondence from here to here is not holomorphic. And I guess that means that, again, if you're working in some family, X over C, this doesn't work, right? So it doesn't work in a family, as far as I know. Anybody correct me on that? The referee of our paper seemed to think this would work in a family, but I don't really understand that. So, okay. All right, so now... Well, so that's most of what I know about the characteristic zero case. Now, for people in algebraic geometry, we don't like to stop here. For us, sort of functoriality condition things are very, very important. So how does this, I said I don't really know how this works in a family, but surely it's true, I don't know if Simpson ever even bothered to say it, that this construction is natural somehow. So if you have a map from X prime to X, and you do the construction on X, you can pull it back to X prime, and everything's compatible. But what about pushing forward? Right, that's a lot more subtle. And I'm going to try to talk about that in our theory. But for pushing forward, you sort of need to have a theory in the family, even to get started. So I don't really know what Simpson's theory says in a family. Anybody tell me anything about that? I mean, there are theories in which you have a variation of Hodge structure of the theory, mixed motives and so on, but that's really different than what's going on here when there isn't the underlying theory of... I'm sorry? Well, suppose I have X over S, right? Then can I still do this? Can I still make this correspondence between things here and things here when I'm working not over X over C, but X over some family? I don't know if I can do that. And I don't know if I can push forward. I'll be more precise when I write down the things in characteristic P. But for one thing, I don't know if this works in a family. Right? If a smooth proper morphism from X to S, does it work? I don't know. All right, so, well, first of all, there is, to some extent, an algebraic version of this in characteristic P due to Deligne and Illouzi. Maybe I should mention it just briefly. So this is part C. This is Deligne and Illouzi. And this is the sort of abelian, perhaps, version analog of that up there. And here, things do work in the family. We have X over S. And also, things don't need to be proper anymore for most of the hard part of the work. So this is a smooth morphism of schemes in characteristic P. And I guess one of the reasons it seems to work better in a family is that we have the relative Frobenius morphism from X to X prime. So I remind you what that means. This is we form the fiber square here. This is the Frobenius pullback like this. And this is the absolute Frobenius map of x. And this is the relative Frobenius map, which I should write fx relative to s, but that might be, I'll just write f for now. I have a diagram like that. And the point is that functions on here, when you pull them back here and differentiate them, you get their zero. Right? So in some sense, the Durand complex on x is already linear over x prime. And that's what makes everything almost trivially linear, linearizable, but we want to sort of make that somewhat less trivial, and that's what we can sometimes do. So and in order for Deligne-Nielsi to work, one needs a little bit more information. One needs a lifting, not of x, but of x prime, to at least not the characteristic 0, but at least mod p squared. So let me fix that. So s tilde will be some mod p squared flat scheme whose reduction modulo p is s, and x prime will be a lifting of that, mod p lifting. We don't need a lifting of x, really, mod p squared lifting. And maybe I'll, it's bad notation, but I'm going to use it. X over S will stand for the whole shebang here, the morphism X over S together with this lifting, X prime tilde to S tilde. Okay. And so that's the information that we're given and allowed to use now. I should mention that sometimes, of course, it is possible also to lift X tilde, but it's not so common to be able to lift the Frobenius morphism from x tilde to x tilde prime. That's pretty rare. Usually lifts locally on x, not globally. And so what Deligne and Elazi were able to do was by sort of comparing different liftings of the Frobenius mapping from x tilde to x tilde prime and using a check argument, which I frankly didn't like all that much, they were able to nevertheless produce a beautiful and canonical isomorphism in the derived category between f lower star of omega dot x over s, and this is a linear complex of ox prime modules, with linear differentials, I mean, and that guy's actually isomorphic to the Hodge complex of x prime. It's a direct sum of the omega q x prime over s minus q. And by the way, by the Cauchy isomorphism, that's the same thing as the cohomology groups or cohomology sheaves omega dot of x over s. And I should put an f lower star there, I guess. This is the Cauchy isomorphism. So this is an isomorphism in the derived category of OX prime modules. And this has all sorts of wonderful consequences, and in particular, they use it to prove Kodaira vanishing and stuff like that. And the interesting thing is, it's this guy that they have to calculate, well, they tensor with some L, and that's the thing that they use, they want to calculate, and they do it by pulling it back to there. It's not the other way around. I'm sorry? Ah, thank you. I forgot. This only is true if the dimension of X is less than P. Actually, less than or equal to P, but they had to use some astuce aquabatique, which I don't want to mention here. Yeah. So actually, equal to P is good for them, but not for me. Okay. All right. So now, Vadim and I wanted to find an analog of this in characteristic P. So let me see how we do this. So this is dates back to about 2005, and we can't do it for all modules with connection. Well, neither could Simpson. He had to put a stability condition here, and we have to do sort of the opposite. Instead of looking at irreducible things, we look at nilpotent things. So that's actually not so bad, because the connections arising in algebraic geometry in many cases seem always to be nilpotent. And not only that, when you're trying to calculate cohomology, somehow it's only the nilpotent part that really contributes. I don't want to make that try to make that precise here, but it's sort of true. So so let me now denote mic L for some integer L of x over s, the category of modules of connection which are nilpotent of level L, meaning there exists a filtration nilpotent of level L. then he does a filtration of length, L plus 1, or L is N0 goes to N1 and so on. Let's write it down. N0E contained in N1 of E, and so on up through NL of E. How many sets is that? L or L plus 1? It's equal to E, such that the associated Gur is constant. And what do I mean by constant? That means that it satisfies the condition that the connection has a full set of solutions, meaning that P curvature is zero. I'll explain what P curvature is a little later. Equivalently, it's the Frobenius upper star of something with the Frobenius descent connection, which is just the identity tensor D. Right, so it's a module on, this guy's a module on X prime, tensored with OX, and this is the identity on the part on X coming from X prime, tensored the identity from D on OX. That's what the connection is. So for modules like that, we have a theory which associates, we call it the Cartier transform in honor of Cartier and the Cartier isomorphism there. So we call it the Cartier transform. It's functorial in X over S, the lifted data there. So it's a functor from the category MIC L X over S, a module connection on X over S, to the category of similarly nilpotent Higgs bundles, X prime over S. And it's actually an equivalence of categories. There are fancier versions of this that I'm not going to explain today, in which we can sort of remove this condition of nilpotence, replace it by something else. I'm not going to talk about that. An equivalence of categories. So it's clear what this is. Right, these are. Again, modules on X like this E prime here, satisfying this linearity condition and integrability. So these correspond really to coherent sheaves on the cotangent bundle, which are supported on the Lth infinitesimal neighborhood of the zero section. That's what the geometric interpretation of that is. And this works in a family. X doesn't have to be proper. And I think somehow the fact that there's a Frobenius linearity here is compensating for the fact that I had to use complex conjugation over there. But it's nice and algebraic. Now, we also have an analog of this statement here, which I want to write down. And of course, since we did it, I have a better understanding of exactly in what sense the isomorphism lives. In particular, it since X doesn't have to be proper, it really is a localizable isomorphism. So namely, what we do, we have, so there exists, so the theorem is, I guess I'll call this a theorem, after we have the construction of the Cartier isomorphism, that, again, if the level L plus the dimension of X over S is less than P, so it's a similar restriction to the one in Deligne and Elouzi, we actually have an isomorphism in the derived category between the Durham complex of this module of connection and the Higgs complex . This is linear isomorphism in the derived category, but I'd rather write a slightly stronger statement, which says the following. I like it because it looks sort of like Hodge theory. There's actually a functorial double complex, and I'm going to take the simple complex associated with that double complex, and I'll call that A dot script X over S, because it's functorial, again, in this lifted data here. I don't know how to make a curly S on the blackboard. E, and so there's actually a canonical quasi-isomorphism in this direction and a canonical quasi-isomorphism in this direction. These are actual maps of complexes, and hence a derived category isomorphism in that direction. And that implies, of course, that the hypercohomologies globally are canonically isomorphic. And this really does work in a family, and that's just the way it goes. Okay, so that means the Durham cohomology of E is canonically isomorphic to the Higgs cohomology of E prime. Okay. All right, so now I want to talk about what does canonically mean? Canonically means functorial in various senses. So that was the title of the talk here. So well, actually, there are various ways to express that functoriality. And I should say that this is still being revised, so I'm a little reluctant that this talk is being recorded, but let me emphasize that this is still, the formulations are constantly changing now. But anyway, here's one way to say it. So let's suppose I have a morphism in characteristic T like this. So I should give these guys names, F and G and H. Then the Frobenius pullback diagrams are functorial, so I get guys like this, S, F prime, and G prime, and here's H prime. I think of S as being some local thing, like it's even interesting if S is a point, but these guys are supposed to think of X and Y as being sort of possibly global, maybe proper over S. And then we can lift this guy. That. So I think that's the most natural notion of naturality that. Yeah, I'm sorry? This is still the same pullback over S. Maybe what you're saying is this is not. Right, I could also take the morphism to Y and take the Frobenius diagram here and take X over. That's not what I mean. That's not what I mean. So, in fact, this morphism usually does not lift a characteristic P, not P squared. So this I can't really use, right? But I'll come back to that point later. Right? So I don't think there's a conflict with notation. What? It's the same X prime tilde there. Yeah. So this exists, but this morphism hardly ever lifts globally, only locally on Y. But Y is supposed to be a global thing now. Thank you. Okay, so, so we have this information. So, of course, if you have a module with connection on Y, you can pull it back to X. Or if you have a Higgs bundle on Y prime, you can pull it back to X prime. And it's not impossible, it's certainly not difficult to think, that given this H tilde prime, one can get an isomorphism between the pullback functors and the Cartier transforms on Y on X, compatible with pullback. That's pretty easy to do. So functorial means, or natural means, is compatible H upper star and H prime upper star. I should perhaps remark that pullback of module connection is not an entirely trivial thing, and neither is pullback here. Of course, it's easy, but it's not just a tensor. You've got to write down the rule for the connection on the pullback, and similarly for the Higgs thing. Okay, but of course, in algebraic geometry, push forward is really especially important too. Actually, when I was a graduate student, since we're talking about the old days, when I first came to Harvard, I took lots of courses from Bott, and I liked Bott's style very much, but he kept talking about integration over the fibers, and I just did not understand what that was. But I think it's RQH lower star, so it's hard. Okay. So, All right. So what is So in our paper in 2005, we discussed push forward a little bit, but the difficulty we had, it's a little embarrassing now, frankly. Is the following. There's this level condition. So when you push forward molecules with connection, the level changes. And for example, if you start off with a trivial connection upstairs on X and push it forward by some H like this, you get a module with connection on Y. That's the Gauss-Winning connection. And it's, I alluded to the fact before, the Gauss-Winning connection is always nilpotent. In fact, a very important influential paper by Nick Katz, which played an enormous role in my own career, is that let's see, example, the Gassmanin connection, RQ H lower star, maybe to H Durham lower star of OX comma D is nilpotent of level, well, what's the level Q or max of Q and D? Let me just write D. This is Katz's theorem. But he used it, he gave lots of important applications of this. I should mention, perhaps, that in Arcata, I was lassoed to give a talk on mixed proof of this. And I thought I understood it really well, and in the course of the proof is based on the Cauchy isomorphism, in fact, and in the course of the proof, I was writing down the proof, and Eric Freelander said, is that compatibility really obvious? Or no, your exact words were, is that supposed to be obvious? And all I could think of on the spot was to say yes. So 30 years later, I don't really know if my answer was correct or not. But you'll see that perhaps the fact that I didn't understand it so well led to our difficulty in the next step. Namely, suppose you start with something which is nilpotent of level L and take its push forward. Well, just by a special sequence argument, you can unravel it, and you see it's in L plus 1 pieces, each one of which is of level D, so the whole thing is going to be of level L plus 1 times D. That's pretty bad. Right, and in the case of things arriving from geometry, you can sort of see the level should be L plus D.
Which number is D?
D is now, I'm sorry, the relative dimension of X over Y. D equals the dimension of X over Y. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So now H is supposed to be smooth. Yeah. Otherwise, the Gassmanin connection isn't really the right thing, and we don't have a good definition of what the push forward is. I think you'd have to do something a little bit fancy, which we don't know how to do yet. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so, so our Cartesian transform doesn't work. So, what we wanted to do was say a theorem something like this. So, why don't I just actually now announce the theorem? And then I'll tell you the history. So here's the actual new theorem, which we think... Can I erase this now? Maybe not. Now here's the theorem, which is still being written. So the first part of the theorem says that, indeed, it is true that if... Let me just write the hypothesis here. H is now smooth of relative dimension D. Then it's really true that pushing forward raises the level by at most D. And similarly on the Higgs side. And secondly, thanks to this fact, it makes sense now to write down a compatibility, which says the following, that given a lifting of H tilde, so given the H tilde prime over there, we get an isomorphism. I could draw a two commutative diagram, but instead let me just draw, write down the morphism here. So here I'm looking at so I start with some moduled connection here, take its Cartesian transform, that gives me a Higgs bundle here. Then I push forward the Higgs bundle, and I get a Higgs bundle there. I'm sorry? Yes. This is here I'm playing the Cartier transform. Oh, here on this side, yes. This should be Y. Thank you. So this RQ H prime Higgs lower star C X over S. And this should be Y prime, yeah. Okay? And the other side I'm going to get, first I take the Durham push forward. And then I take the Cartier transform on Y. And I get an isomorphism of functors, maybe I'll call it capital theta, which depends on the lifting H prime tilde, like that. All right. So there are two pieces of information here. One is just the fact that the cohomology groups are isomorphic to each other. And the other is, well, for example, if Y equals S, let's take that special case. If Y equals S, this just says the cohomology groups are isomorphic to each other, and that's just the consequence of the statement that I had, which I called formality, I guess, up there. So if Y equals S, this reduces to that statement, right? But in general, there's first of all a statement these guys are isomorphic, but second, there's a statement, this is an isomorphism of objects compatible with the Higgs fields, right? So there's some additional structure there, not just saying that the sheaves are isomorphic as sheaves. So I don't have any statement like this in the Simpson theory. Does anybody? This is what I was asking about. Okay. Maybe, again, there's some theory for the category of mixed Hodge modules or some nice functorial like this, but the point here is that there's no Hodge structure underlying anything. So I have only a few minutes to describe what goes on here. But I think what I'm going to emphasize is the new insight somehow that enabled us to overcome our psychological difficulty. It's, I think it was Deligne who said all difficulties in mathematics are psychological. Somehow we thought it was hard to prove this level result. So let me just explain the history there a little bit. Let's see. Yeah, I have to say a little bit about how things work. So what the p-curvature is. So I should review the p-curvature. So if I have a module with connection, so that means for each derivation, for each c, the derivation of x over s, I get Knobloch sub xi is a nonlinear endomorphism. It's an endomorphism of E only linear over Ox prime. And I can take its pth iterate. But the pth iterate of a derivation is also a derivation. So I also have Knobloch of xi to the p. And the difference between... So I should indicate something here. Xi to the p means the iterate of xi is a derivation. It's not the pth power of xi is a differential operator. So didn't indicate that. I'm going to put a parenthesis there. And the difference between these two things turns out actually to be linear. And that, by definition, is the p curvature of xi. And so it turns out this xi is not only is it linear, but it's also horizontal. So this is a really amazing fact, and the p-curvature has been studied a lot. Again, I think it was Katz who really emphasized and proved the importance of the p-curvature by various of his works. Turns out that this mapping, which takes a peak, the derivation to its corresponding p-curvature, is itself p-linear. And so if you unravel that, what you get is not exactly a Higgs field, but what's called an F-Higgs field. So xi is actually a map from E to E tensor not omega 1, but F upper star of omega 1, and more precisely F upper star of omega 1 of x prime over S. And this is linear now and horizontal. And horizontal means that it commutes with the connection here, and the connection here where I put the Frobenius descent connection on that. So that's really important to know. So this, the fact that this is sort of an ethics field is already a tiny hint that there should be some way of using the p-curvature to make some sort of analog of non-Newtonian Hodge theory. The trouble is we want to get not an F-Higgs field, but a Higgs field. We want to get an omega x prime here instead. So there's more work to do before we can do that. So I haven't got time to review very much the actual construction in great detail, but it's quite geometric. Again, the idea is to look at liftings of Frobenius as in Deline and Illouzi, but I didn't want to use a Czech construction. I used to like Czech cohomology when I was a student of Bach, but I don't like it anymore. And so instead of looking at Czech cohomology and comparing liftings, we look at the set of all liftings of Frobenius, which actually forms a torsor, a beautiful algebraic torsor over X. In fact, it forms a crystal of torsors. I haven't got time to explain that, but in particular, the algebra of liftings, I mean, the algebra of functions on the set of the torsor of liftings of Frobenius. Let me write down something. L of X over F is equal to the torsor of liftings of Frobenius. So let me write that down roughly. This is not exactly how it works, but we look at all possible liftings from X prime to X. The X tilde prime is given, right? So look at open subsets more precisely of X tilde, or even crystalline thickenings of open subsets of X tilde, and look at maps from there into X tilde prime, which lift the Frobenius. This actually has a nice crystal structure, which is easy to explain geometrically, but I don't have time to do that. And the sheaf of functions on it, A, of X over, so this is actually it's a torsor. I don't have time to explain too much. A is the sheaf of functions, so more precisely, L of X over F is equal to spec of this guy relative to X. So it's an affine torsor over X. And the structure of this algebra is very easy to understand because of the fact that it's a torsor. It looks locally like the thing over which it's a torsor, namely the symmetric algebra on F upper star of omega dot of X prime over F, since, in fact, the set of liftings is a torsor under that. So, right. And so it only looks locally like that, but some of the information here is also global. So in particular, it has the filtration, which is associated graded, is actually equal to that. So it has the filtration, n dot. So if n0 equals O, contained in n1, contained and so on, the associated graded is isomorphic to this guy. It has a connection. And the connection, well, it doesn't look locally like this, but the associated graded does. So the important thing about the connection is that it's very rich. It's a nilpotent connection. Associated graded is the Frobenius descent connection here, but it's not zero connection. In some sense, it's as if it were the universal nilpotent connection, part of the way up anyway. And that's the reason you can use it to solve differential equations, and it's the reason that the whole Cartier transform works. So in particular, the P curvature of this connection is very rich. Let me write down a diagram which explains just how rich it is. Well, first of all, a little out of time, but one way to say it is this. So the P curvature is a map from AX over S into AX over S, and as before, tensored with F upper star of omega 1 of X prime over S. On the other hand, we have D, which maps AX over S into omega 1, well, of L. This is the sheaf of functions on L, and let me just take L of X over S relative to S, but in fact, I'll just take relative to X. And because X over S is a torsor over the group schema corresponding to that spec, this omega 1 is canonically isomorphic to that. And so these two are canonically isomorphic to each other, and the diagram actually commutes. That tells me that taking the P curvature up here is just sort of like differentiating in the symmetric algebra, which means it's very rich, until you get up to degree P, when it's zero again. So it's no good, right? So it's rich up into degree P. And in particular, so the bottom line here is that N sub P minus 1 of A has very good P curvature. It's sort of this really is the maximal sort of a universal nilpotent connection on X of nilpotent of level p minus 1. And the amazing thing about it is that it lives globally and has a functorial construction just given this lifting. And we actually proved that it's not possible to go further by actually giving some examples for certain surfaces in any global way. So I can't explain exactly what that means right now. So I want to mention now explain how this Cartier transform actually works. So you can see how we get the functoriality. So there are fancier versions, but the down-to-earth version that I want to get here is just the following. So given a module of connection of level L, let me let N be some integer which is less than or equal to P minus 1 and greater than L, or equal to L actually. What I can do is take E and tensor with this universal peak nilpotent connection like that. And it turns out when you do, and I like to think of this as being this AX over S, if I didn't have to restrict to these small levels, unfortunately I do, if I didn't have to, I think of this as being some sort of analog of maybe the sheaf of analytic functions in characteristic zero, or maybe C infinity functions. Because by tensoring with this, we can get now lots of solutions to our differential equations. And you take the solution to this differential equations, like that, and that's the Cartier transform. And because I've taken the solutions here, Knobel, remember, is OX prime linear. So this is actually a sheaf of OX prime modules, canonically. And because of the fact that the P curvature is commutes with Knobel, it turns out there's a tiny calculation to do, but if I take if I put here the P curvature of this guy, which is an OX linear map tensored with the identity here, this diagram, in fact, the point is this guy commutes with Knobel. So this actually maps here into here. And here I should put tensor F upper star. Well, now there's no longer F upper star anymore because I'm taking the invariance. So just omega 1 of X prime over S, like that. So here I'm taking, this is the invariance of the Frobenius descent connection on that, which is giving me omega prime X over S. So this is now a Higgs field because I'm actually going into omega prime X prime over S with no more F upper star. So that's an object in Higgs. Okay, so that's the definition of the Cartier transform, and now I can define this complex A dot up there. Let me tell you exactly what it is. It's a simple complex associated with double complex, and you can guess what it's just really tempting when you write this down to write down the whole double complex. I need to make some abbreviations so I can get things on the board. So we have E tensored with NL and N. I'll leave out the A here. Goes to E tensor N tensor omega 1 of X over S, and you go on like this. That's right in this direction. And clearly we have a map from the Derom complex into here. Right, there's a map of complexes like this. But now what we can do is here I'm going to put identity tensor the T curvature of A. This is our marvelous thing here. And this is the D, or the Knobel. And this diagram commutes. And, well, as I said before, this is just the identity tensor psi. This psi is, this looks like the Durham complex on the symmetric algebra. So, well, the filtered Poincaré lemma, this column is exact, right? So this, here I'm going to get an actual resolution of the thing down there, right? I can go on like this. Okay? And now, you see, what's the kernel here? The kernel here is E prime. And the kernel here, well, it'll be E prime. Well, I have to put here, I'm sorry, I forgot tensor F upper star of omega 1 of X prime over S. And what's the kernel here? The kernel here is going to be E prime tensored with omega 1 of X prime over S, provided that the level is still bigger than M minus 1. Right? And if I keep on going up, it'll be E prime tensor omega D. Well, I should write the dimension of X over S, really, to avoid confusion, et cetera, provided, so this works if the level, if the level L plus the dimension of X over S is less than N, less than or equal to N, which we call as less than P. Okay? So this is almost obviously a quasi-isomorphism. This guy, the rows here are not exact, unfortunately. But nevertheless, it's true that the map from the simple, so let's let A be, so we get, if I look at the corresponding symbol complexes, I get the Higgs complex, E prime, omega dot like this, goes into the corresponding simple complex, A dot, X over S, E. Here I've got an N sub N. Here I've got the Durham complex. So this is a quasi-isomorphism. That was easy. The fact that this is a quasi-isomorphism is more difficult and requires a local calculation, which fortunately is a local calculation. And to do the local calculation, you can, in fact, choose a lifting of Frobenius on X because it's local. Locally, such a thing exists. And then what you do is the lifting of Frobenius defines a section of the torsor, and you take the completion, the PD envelope of the torsor along that section, which enables you to replace this algebra there by its divided power of completion, right? And then you have a Poincaré lemma going the other direction as well. And that's how the local calculation works. All right. So this looks pretty natural and certainly easily compatible with pullback. What about push forward? So let me just say a word about the strategy of the proof and sort of why we were a little bit stuck. So, yes? Yes. Yeah, here. So what, these maps here, yeah. These maps are just D, right? This is D everywhere. And here, this is the Frobenius descent connection, right? So it's just the identity on omega 1 x prime over S. That's how the Frobenius descent connection works. Okay. Okay, so now suppose I had the diagram with the mapping to Y. What do we do? Well, what you can do is replace this complex here. I won't write it. Instead of putting X over S everywhere, put X over Y. And put X over Y in the primes also. The diagram is still going to exist. Right? However, the kernels here won't be exact anymore. And what's going to happen? So, namely, what happens? A lifting H tilde prime from X tilde prime to Y tilde prime, that induces, I won't write down the details, if you a relationship between the liftings of Frobenius here and the liftings of Frobenius here, and you get actually a mapping from A, Y over S, pull back into A X over S, like that. That comes from this H tilde. And in fact, in low degrees, this is precisely the kernel of the P curvature mapping. When you take instead of relative to X over X prime over S, relative to X prime over Y prime instead. So, in fact, what you get if you replace everything here by replace this X prime over S by X prime over Y prime, what you get is not a resolution of E, but a resolution of E tensored with H upper star of AY. So here's the diagram. I'll just write down the total diagram here. We get morphisms like this. We get on the bottom, we get the Durham complex of E of relative to y now, but now tensored with h upper star of ay. And that maps into this relative version of that guy, x, y over s is what we're going to call it. And this is still a quasi-isomorphism. Okay? And now on the right, well, let's just use the same old thing that we had there. I'm not going to say it's a quasi-isomorphism anymore, but it's a map from here that still exists like that. All right. And what happens if you push forward? If we push forward, we use the projection formula to get, on the left side, we get the Duranc homology tensored with AQ of Y. Well, let's take just a level, some level N sub N here. And that's going to be receiving, because it's a quasi-isomorphism there. I have an arrow in this direction, which is not a quasi-isomorphism, but here I'm going to get the RQ H Higg lower star of E prime. And it's not difficult to check that this isomorphism has the following properties. First of all, it's compatible with the Higgs field here, and the Higgs field here is trivial here, but it comes from the Higgs field there. It's compatible with the Higgs field. And secondly, it factors through the horizontal sections. In our original paper, the idea had been, the original strategy of the proof was to show there was an isomorphism here after I tensored again with NL. But I couldn't do that. Right? We didn't know how to do that. So we did have this arrow. So and it factors like this. And this guy factors through here. Okay, so how to prove that we actually get an isomorphism? So the way it works now is it can be done in many different ways, but one way to say it is the following. So to prove this actually is an isomorphism is a local statement on Y now. Y doesn't have to be global anymore. So on Y, we can choose a lifting of Frobenius. If we choose a lifting of Frobenius on Y, then we do get this lifting of X tilde over Y just by pulling back the lifting from X prime. This actually does lift now. And that means we have we can regard Y now as being like the S before, because we have now a lifting of X tilde over this Y tilde. Right? So now we can compare this isomorphism to the case of X over S isomorphism. And that, remember, that guy was constructed sort of the same way. I haven't got time to write the details now, but now the S simply becomes Y. It turns out that after pulling back by Frobenius, we've got a mapping more precisely from here to X prime, and you've got to pull back from Y prime. This isomorphism actually becomes that isomorphism when you, remember, I chose a lifting of Frobenius on Y. That means a section of this. So more precisely, if I pull back by that section, I get a mapping like this. Right? I have a section back from here into OY, and it turns out that this isomorphism becomes the isomorphism which I call the from the absolute case. So what's the upshot? It means that we've constructed, just sort of cosmologically, a full set of solutions, really, of this differential equation when I tensor with NL, because I've got enough guys to actually, when I pull back along the zero section, generate the whole module. That means a priori, or a posteriori, this differential equation had to have level at most n, right? And that means that the level couldn't go up by more than D. So this implies the level result and that we have an isomorphism, right? Because this guy is exactly equal to the Cartier transform on Y of RQ H Durham lower star of E. I couldn't have said that until I knew there were enough horizontal sections to know that the level N was enough to really get me there. Well, anyway, so when we realized this, we just couldn't believe that you had to go through all this big complicated thing to prove that the level goes up by at most the relative dimension. And so sure enough, after 2 or 3 days of work, we found direct simple proofs of statement A, which don't involve the Cartier transform, but we just couldn't have done it until we noticed this. So I think I should stop there.
Questions, anyone?
Yes. Well, that's a really fair question. And the only thing that I can say definitively that we have is not so new. Namely, we did find a proof of the theorem of Voronoff and Kutsevich, which is a theorem completely in characteristic zero, by characteristic P techniques. And that's pretty, at first it seems kind of bizarre, because I don't want to give you the exact statement of the theorem, but the philosophical point is interesting, because there we have to analyze a connection which is not at all nilpotent, right? But nevertheless, you can sort of approximate it by nilpotent things. Any connection you can sort of approximate by nilpotent things. And as I said before, somehow all the cohomology in characteristic P of a connection exists when you restrict the to the formal completion, anyway, of the zero section of the cotangent bundle. And by carefully working out how well we can approximate for various primes P, we're able to get the result in characteristic zero. So there are some. Yeah. I should also perhaps mention that Helen, I think, asked me some questions about some results of Peek and Rossler considering the original title, which is Cohomology of Hodge Cohomology in Invertible Sheaves. I think hoping that I could find some applications of this theory to that, but in fact we did find some, but they really only use the Deligny-Lozzi theory. They don't use this fancy theory, so it would be misleading to say that it was also an application thereof.